Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Tuesday, February 14th, 2017. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, we'll meet poet Roger Reeves, who will be reading at the Valley Library tonight. We'll talk with KJ Metcalf and Dan Monteith about the upcoming Friends of Admiralty meeting. Betsy Dorn of the Legislative Information Office will be here to tell us about Wednesday's legislative open house. And JDHS Counselor Jennifer Neggs and students will be here to talk about Kindness Week activities. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here, live and local on a Juno afternoon. Currently 43 degrees at the Juno Airport.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders at the annual State of Indian Nations address Monday expressed both optimism and trepidation about the new presidential administration. National Congress of American Indians President Brian Cladasby promised to work in a bipartisan way. Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
It's no secret that many tribal leaders already miss President Obama and his administration, which President Cladasby alluded to in his address.
The federal election in November marked the end of the Obama presidency and the most successful government-to-government relationship Indian people have enjoyed since the formation of the United States. We welcome President Trump and look forward to working with the Trump administration to build on the tremendous successes of the last 8 years.
There remain many unknowns with how the Trump administration will deal with Indian country when it comes to pressing needs on health care, education, and substance abuse. But Cladasby is promising that tribal leaders stand ready to work with the new president and lawmakers in both parties.
I am reminded that throughout American history, in challenging times and changing times, Native people have remained a constant. We are, in the words of Chief Seattle, like the stars that never change.
But there's fear among some tribal leaders. Terry Pepper is the tribal secretary for the Kaw Nation of Oklahoma. She says she worries about how minorities will be treated over the next 4 years.
I mean, I just don't want to take steps back in this country, not only with women. I don't want to become second-class citizens again, and as well as Native Americans.
Other tribal leaders report optimism, even in the face of uncertainty. Ernest Stevens is of the Wolf Clan of Oneida, Wisconsin, and chairs the National Indian Gaming Association.
We'll have some bumps in the road, and we'll have some work to do, but we're ready to do that. And it's not the first time we've had to take on an administration that we don't know so well. As a matter of fact, many of our leaders, our elders, and our ancestors have had to go in with situations no different.
Tribal leaders are in Washington for the week, meeting with lawmakers in both parties and federal officials. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
A U.S. Senate committee has advanced a proposal to federally recognize a landless Montana tribe, which has sought federal recognition for almost four decades. Montana Public Radio's Edward O'Brien reports.
The Senate Indian Affairs Committee has approved a measure to both recognize the tribe and give it 200 acres to use as a land base. Both Montana Senators, Democrat John Tester and Republican Steve Daines, sit on that committee and support the bill. Tester says the little shell, quote, have been bounced around a bit by the bureaucracy.
And that is a gross understatement. The lineage is there. There's little doubt about that.
Little Shell Chairman Gerald Gray says the tribe has several pathways to federal recognition. One of them is the tribe's ace in the hole.
Which we're really keeping our fingers crossed and very hopeful is Ryan Zinke being selected for the Secretary of the Interior. He could recognize us on his own.
Montana Republican Representative Zinke supports the Little Shell's bid. Federal recognition would enable the tribe's 6,000 members to be eligible for federal government benefits ranging from health care to education. For National Native News, I'm Edward O'Brien.
A request by the Standing Rock and Cheyenne River Sioux tribes for a temporary restraining order to block construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota was denied in federal court Monday. However, the Cheyenne River Sioux tribe did receive a date for hearing on its preliminary injunction set for the end of the month. The tribe is challenging the legality of the decision to grant an easement to allow the pipeline to run under Lake Oahe. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by the Peace Corps, volunteers make a difference working in communities in over 60 countries, tackling their greatest challenges in education, health, agriculture, environment, and business. Information available at peacecorps.gov. That's peace, C-O-R-P-S.gov. When you file online for your PFD, every Alaskan can support great causes like National Native News. Just select KNBA-FM Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, February 14th, 2017. Scott Burton, your host, and with me now in the studio is poet Roger Reeves and Beth Weigel from the Juno Public Library. Welcome to the show, Roger and Beth.
Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
It's so nice to have you here. Roger, you just flew in from Illinois, from Chicago?
Yes, yeah, just flew in yesterday.
Well, it's an honor to have you here. Beth, this is a collaboration between the Juno Public Library and 49 Writers, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So Jeremy Pataki, the director for the 49 Writers group, he contacted me and said, hey, we're bringing this poet, Roger Reeves, on a tour. Would you like to have him stop in Juno and do a presentation at the Juno Library? And I said, absolutely.
Yes, please.
So Jeremy did some really fast work with writing a grant to the Alaska Humanities Forum and getting the support of the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and our friends, of course, of the Juno Public Libraries put in some money, and here he is. We're really excited about that.
Well, it's great to have you here. Let's see, you teach at the University of Chicago. Too many fellowships to mention, awards. Is King Me your most recent book here?
It is. It's my first book.
All right. If you had to explain to our listening audience what kind of poet you are, how would you describe yourself?
Well, I would say I'm an American poet first, and then I'm also a lyric poet, right? So, and most of the poets that you're going to encounter now, you know, are lyric poets. There's a few poets that are writing a narrative, but generally I'm a lyric poet that's really interested in encountering thematically in his work, American history, as well as sort of ideas of love. I think that too often we think about these as polar opposites or poles, and I often want to think about the way you love something is often through its engaging it, right? So I think engaging the political, engaging the sociological is a love for it, engaging race, right? And then you have the more traditional ideas of love poems like epithalamium and sonnets. I play with something called a curdled sonnet, which is 13 lines or 12 and a half lines playing off of Hopkins, Gerald Manley Hopkins type of thing. It's not sprung rhythm-y, but formally very similar.
Would you consider sharing one of your works with us?
Sure. This poem is actually, I think, probably relevant in the sense that it is cold, and it is winter. It's called Before Diagnosis. The lake is dead for a second time this January, and no matter how many geese lay their warm breast against the ice or fly across its hard chest, it doesn't break or sink or open up and swallow them. The ice is frozen water. There is no metaphor for exile. Even if these trees continue to shake the crows from their branches, my sister is still farther away from her mind than we are from each other, sitting on opposite ends of a park bench, waiting for the evening to swallow us whole. In the last moments of a depressive sun, my sister says a man is chasing a goose through the snow.
Thank you for sharing that very much. Can you tell us a little bit about what you plan to do tonight at the library?
Sure. I'm going to read more poems, read lots of poems, and then talk a bit about something that I'm quite interested in, which is this thing called parhesia, which is a Greek term for frank speech. And it sort of is the beginnings of our freedom of speech. And I'm particularly interested in thinking about what is it to sort of speak frankly now in a post-fact era? What does that mean for poems? When I say post-fact, I think about, you know, the declaration of all this fake news, right? Or even there was some fact-checkers during the election basically said 78% of most of what Donald Trump said was false. But that seemed to not matter, right? There used to be a time when one's ethos was about how true one's speech was. And it seems like we're in a different place now. And so I'm really interested in, well, what does that mean for poems? What does that mean for us as the citizenry? How do we engage this moment when we are living lives that sometimes contradict the post-fact era, that sometimes we have some facts in our lives that we need to change or that need to be addressed, like, you know, economic issues, right, or issues around race, issues around gender. So tonight I'm going to be going to be a small discussion from my part on something much larger, but thinking about Parhesia, right, Frank's speech in this moment.
Speaking of this moment, do you feel like there's more responsibility on you as an artist?
You know, it's funny. It's kind of why this essay, I started writing this essay, which is a lot of poets were after the election were quite surprised by the results. And I have to say, I was and I wasn't. I think I've been a black man in America for 37 years. So therefore, this just looked like business as usual in a lot of ways. So in terms of my own writing, I'd always felt quite responsible, if that's a term, to address my life, right? And to address my life as it intersects with aesthetics and art. So I don't feel anything more. I think I've been doing this, right? I think I've been since I was living in Texas when Hurricane Katrina happened. And so a lot of people were evacuated to Texas, a lot of folks from New Orleans. And I remember that as such a pivotal moment. I was in graduate school, and I said, oh, wow, so this is really how much America doesn't like black people, right? It was a moment for me when I sort of woke up. So to me, I think what's happening is just more of that in a very different way. You know, the seeing the burgeoning of what we're calling the alt-right, but which is just really white nationalism. That had never gone anywhere. You know, if you've lived in rural places as I have, or lived in New Jersey where, you know, that you see things like that, you know, it's just America. I think this is just a cycle. And so in terms of my art, I feel like what I'm interested in doing is doing more, right? Doing more addressing of that.
Did you come to poetry first, or were you a prose writer?
I came to poetry by making, when I was a kid, I couldn't afford to buy birthday cards for friends. And we'd go to their like birthday parties. And so I would take out the comics from the newspaper and then I would write little poems, acrostic poems, for them. So it was kind of out of economic necessity that I became a poet. But also, I did write prose, but, there was something about poems that always sort of pulled me back. But I think that writers write. I write plays. I write scholarship. I write reviews, you know, so I write whatever comes.
Okay. I was watching one of your talks this morning on YouTube, and I, among the things I like that you said was, and maybe this was advice to young poets or aspiring poets, take a risk where the poem wobbles. Experiment. Can you elaborate on that
a
little bit?
Sure. I always learned in grad school that where the poem wobbles or where it seems to be most faulty is actually where the poet is trying something new. It's almost like a deer, you know, being birthed and it's getting up on new legs, right? And so that's the new legs of the poem. And that's where the poet actually has most to not only teach us, but also to show him or herself about possibility in their own imagination. So for me, I'm interested in those moments, right? Those risky moments, as a poet and as a writer, like even this, you know, talking about Parhesia, right? Like I'm not a classic scholar, right? But I'm pulling on a lot of sort of classical material to talk about it. So I find that to be a risk. And so I'm really interested in poets like, and writers sort of going to those places that are uncomfortable.
What's other advice you give to your students?
My favorite piece of advice, and it's one I have to remember all the time, which is don't intend anything, but attend to the work, right? I think too often we want. You're like, oh, we got the piece has to have all of this or be this type of thing. It has to manifest this type of beauty, when in actuality the poem only has to be itself. And sometimes poems have minds of their own, and you should follow that mind. So that's attending to the poem. Even though it's part of you and the poem's coming out of you, there's something maybe that is more pressing than what you intend. So attend, don't intend.
Okay. And perhaps people should attend tonight.
Yes.
Okay, right? You set that up so good. You set that up so good.
Yeah.
We were working on that earlier. Yes, you should attend tonight at the Valley Library, 6 p.m., Roger will be there to read some sweet poems, some poems that will make you think. It's going to be the perfect, like, Valentine's Day date thing to go do with your loved one.
I'm definitely reading love poems tonight.
Yeah. It's going to be like that little edgy type of Valentine's Day poetry reading, I think. Mm-hmm. So we hope to see you out there.
It sounds great, and I assume admission is free?
Admission is always free for library events.
Well, thanks to you and 49 Writers, and thank you, Roger Reeves. This is really good to have you here. And am I missing anything? Anything either of you'd like to add?
No, just come out.
Yeah, just come on out.
All right, 6 p.m. tonight, Valley Library. Once again.
somewhere you go each day to see you alive. Yeah, 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 to see you alive. Oh, oh, talk to me some more. You know that you don't have to go. You're the poetry man. You make things make things alright.
Enjoy an Admiralty Island afternoon and evening, Saturday, February 18th at the Juno Yacht Club. All are welcome to the Friends of Admiralty annual meeting and potluck. Business meeting from 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. Don't miss an illustrated presentation and discussion of Southeast Alaska's ancient landscapes and ancient people by geologist Jim Bechtel and anthropologist Dan Montia from 3 to 5 p.m. Potluck and dessert auction at 5:30. Evening program from 7 to 8:30 p.m. That's Saturday, February 18th at the Juno Yacht Club. All are welcome.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, February 14th, 2017. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 20 minutes past the top of the hour, and in the studio now is Dan Monteith, an anthropologist out at the University of Alaska Southeast, and also KJ Metcalf, a big part of the Friends of Admiralty. Welcome to the show, you two.
Thank you, Scott.
Yeah. Welcome. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah,
good to be here.
Nice to have you here. KJ, let's start with you. Friends of Admiralty Island.
Right. So we having an annual meeting this Saturday at the Yacht Club, and it's, I think, going to be an incredible day, and I'm really looking forward to this. So we have a business meeting at 1:30, which is about an hour. Kind of have to have that once a year anyway. But at 3 o'clock, Jim and Dan are going to have a two-hour discussion on a subject that is near and dear to my heart, and it's the ancient history of Southeast Alaska, what the landscape looked like, what the seascape looked like, and what the first people saw when they arrived here and who they might have been. And it's just the things that they're finding out more recently are adding a great deal to the knowledge. So that it's going to be a two-hour discussion, and then we have our potluck at 5:30, and our potlucks are legendary. They are just great, and there'll be a dessert and bread silent auction, so if you plan to come, it would be great to bring a dessert or artisan bread, or just come and bid often and high.
Okay.
And then we have a program that evening, which is a continuation of the afternoon discussion.
Okay. I want to come back and talk more about the Friends of Admiralty Island in a minute. But, Dan, let's go to you for a sec. Give us a few highlights. What do you plan to talk about that day?
Yeah. Jim Bechtel is going to be the featured speaker, and I'm going to kind of be tag-teaming with him there. But what we're looking at is research that's been done in the last 10, 20 years, and we're standing on the shoulders of other people here in Juneau, Roman Motika and my old colleague Kathy Connor, and then the ladies out at the Juneau Ranger District, Rachel Myron and Myra Gillum. And we've all gone out and we've done a lot of work looking at how the landscape's changed in the last 10 to 20,000 years. And one of the things that Jim has done is down on Prince of Wales Island, he started looking at how the landscapes changed with the glaciers and the presence of the glaciers, especially around here. As the glaciers start to recede, it's kind of like putting a big rock on a sponge. And as you start moving that rock back, the sponge just kind of lifts up. And we know around here in the Juneau area, where we have a glacier, of course, right in our city limits, that the rebound is about anywhere from a year to inch a decade or so. So we're kind of recovering a lot of waterfront real estate quickly. And the interesting thing that Jim has been doing work with an archaeologist down in Prince of Wales Island, Risa Carlson, they've been trying to figure out where would the old human occupation sites be. Plain and simple, old school archaeologists were looking right down on the shorelines where they are today.
And what we're finding on Prince of Wales Island, they're 20 meters up into the woods, the 8 to 10,000-year-old sites. And up until a few years ago, we only had a half dozen of these older human occupation sites. And so we've been putting that model that they've been doing with working with geographical information systems, and it's been amazing what they found down there. And it's a little more complex. It's a little more dynamic up here. But we found about 750 feet up the mountain as you're going towards Eagle Crest on Fish Creek. We found about a 13,000-year-old beach terrace where the terrestrial landscape comes down and meets the beach. And we found a few others just in the last few years. So we'll be talking about landscape change, where people might have been, so many things about the climate and the ecology at the end of the Pleistocene, beginning of the Holocene about 10,000 years ago.
Sounds like a very exciting time.
Yeah. I know down in some of the caves they found ring seal remains, and ring seal are in the Arctic, and where there's shelf saltwater ice. And so they must have had enough ice down here to support that population. And polar bears were, scientists believe, the forerunners for Admiralty, Baranoff, and Chichagof bears. And so if there were ring seals, there probably were polar bears here too.
Wow. Very interesting. And again, this talk is going to happen this Saturday from 3 to 5 at the Yacht Club.
Right, and again at 7 to about 8 o'clock or 8:30.
Okay, and that will be a continuation of that first talk. But it seems like pretty much from 1:30 on, if you are a friend of Admiralty or want to be a friend of Admiralty, you
right.
can come to the Yacht Club.
Yeah, and it's open to everybody.
And speak to that a little bit. What is the Friends of Admiralty Island all about, KJ?
Well, we're an organization that started in 1997 as a public advocacy group to help keep Admiralty wild and promote education and scientific efforts on the island.
Okay.
And so that's what we've been doing, and this Saturday is a good example of some of that education and knowledge that I think people would really enjoy learning about.
Yeah, that's about 20 years now since 97, right?
Right.
What are you most proud of in that time?
Well, I think the work that we've done at Hawk Inlet and the study that we've done over the last 2.5 years has been probably the most significant effort. Certainly, the results of the testing that we did there of sediment, water, and plant and animal tissue has began to show us an entirely different kind of inlet than what agencies thought might be happening because of the mine. I think the mine is portrayed as a model mine. I think it could be if the treatment of the tailings and water was different. So that's what we're advocating. That mine probably will be there another 50 years or 75 years. And the legacy that we want to see left is a clean environment.
Okay. Dan, can you give us maybe one more highlight about what you might talk about on Saturday?
Yeah, well, or for the audience, I just would really encourage teachers and students and general public that wants to learn more about the natural and human history of Southeast Alaska, particularly the afternoon, but the evening presentation also will be really geared towards a general audience. And Jim is an extremely dynamic speaker and has incredible slides and visuals to go along with what we'll be talking about. And we hope to have a few other folks who have done this sort of research and just kind of have a research exchange, but a very good educational kind of presentation.
Okay. KJ, if people want more information, where should they go?
Well, they could go to friendsofadmiralty.org, or they could call me at 586-6738.
Okay. K.J. Metcalf and Dan Monteith are among the individuals who will be at this Saturday's Friends of Admiralty meeting at the Juno Yacht Club. Everything starts at 1:30 and goes through the evening. More information at friendsofadmiralty.org.
Right.
Great, gentlemen. Anything else?
No, that wraps it up. Thank you, Scott.
Yeah. Thank you.
Have a good afternoon.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 13th of February, 2017. It was on this date, 1633, Galileo Galilei was brought to Rome to face charges of heresy for teaching that the sun and not the earth was the center of the universe. He had studied the work of Copernicus, the Polish astronomer who'd put forward the theory that the earth was not even the center of the solar system. Galileo was found guilty of heresy, ordered to recant, and he did. He said, "I abjure, curse, and detest the aforesaid errors and heresies, and swear that in the future I will never again say or assert anything that might furnish occasion for a similar suspicion." It's the birthday of the mystery writer Georges Simenon, Belgian, born in Liège, 1903, wrote over 500 novels and short stories, many of them featuring the detective Jules Magret, who enjoyed fine wine and his wife, and solving cases by pondering human nature. Simenon could write 80 pages a day, sometimes finish the draft of a novel in 10 days. He said, "Writing is not a profession, but a vocation of unhappiness. I don't think an artist can ever be happy." It's the birthday of the religious historian Elaine Pagels, born in Palo Alto, California, 1943, author of the Gnostic Gospels, and especially the Gospel of Thomas, which says that Jesus is the one who reveals the divine light that brought the universe into being, and that you and I also reveal that light. And it's the birthday of the first man to travel faster than the speed of sound, Chuck Yeager, born in Myra, West Virginia, 1923. He did it in 1947, got up to an altitude of 45,000 feet, and 14 minutes later he was back on the ground. Here's a poem for today by Dorian Laux, Anti-Lamentation. "Regret nothing. Not the cruel novels you read to the end just to find out who killed the cook, not the insipid movies that made you cry in the dark in spite of your intelligence, your sophistication, not the lover you left quivering in a hotel parking lot, the one you beat to the punchline, the door, or the one who left you in your red dress and shoes, the ones that crimped your toes, don't regret those. Not the nights you called God names and cursed your mother, sunk like a dog in the living room couch, chewing your nails and crushed by loneliness. You were meant to inhale those smoky nights over a bottle of flat beer to sweep stuck onion rings across the dirty restaurant floor, to wear the frayed coat with its loose buttons, its pockets full of struck matches. You've walked those streets 1,000 times, and still you end up here. Regret none of it, not one of the wasted days you wanted to know nothing when the lights from the carnival rides were the only stars you believed in, loving them for their uselessness, not wanting to be saved. You've traveled this far on the back of every mistake, ridden in dark-eyed and morose, but calm as a house after the TV set has been pitched out the upstairs window, harmless as a broken axe, emptied of expectation. Relax. Don't bother remembering any of it. Let's stop here, under the lit sign on the corner, and watch all the people walk by." Thank you. A poem by Dorian Laux, Anti-Lamentation, from the Book of Men, published by W.W. Norton & Company and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Lumosity, brain training with over 50 challenging games, from scientists working with university researchers to push cognitive research forward. Learn more at lumosity.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Tobacco smoke impacts a child's developing brain. When removed from the smoking environment, a child can experience withdrawal symptoms. This includes irritability, anxiety, and difficulty learning. Protect your child's health. Protect your health. Start today by planning to quit. Call or enroll online for free support from Alaska's Tobacco Quitline at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message is brought to you by the Partnership for a Tobacco-Free Southeast and SEARCH.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, February 14th. It's about 25 minutes until the top of the hour. And on the show now is Betsy Dorn. She's a Juno Information Officer at the Legislative Information Office. Welcome to the show, Betsy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, so an open house, a legislative open house tomorrow, Wednesday. Tell us about it.
Sure. So the Juno Legislative Information Office is opening its doors to the public, and we're asking that people come in, kind of get a sense of who we are and what we do and how they can connect with the legislature, because that's the mission of the Legislative Information Offices across the state, is to connect people from the public with the legislative process and with their legislators. So we're trying to open our doors and get the public in to answer any questions and give people the resources that they may need to access their elected representatives.
All right, and so this is at 6 o'clock tomorrow night?
Yep, at 6 o'clock until about 7:30, and that'll be in the Terry Miller Legislative Office Building. And for those of you longtime Junoites, it's the old Capitol School, so directly behind the Capitol Building is where you can find us.
Okay, and what can people expect when they get there?
Well, we're going to have staff from the Legislative Information Office and hopefully members of the Juno delegation. They all have indicated their interest in attending, which is certainly dependent on their schedules. You know, middle of session, people can be a little bit busy and unexpected things can pop up, but we're really hoping to see the faces of the Juno delegation there. But at the very least, you'll have staff from the Legislative Information Office who would be happy to kind of go through how we connect people with the process and how you as an average citizen can influence your legislators and how you can make your voice heard, particularly during this session.
I've been hearing a lot about going back to the old school phone call. And I know people are doing that in Washington anyway. Does that still work here in Juno? And can you give us a few hints or highlights of what you might be talking about tomorrow as far as best access?
Sure. And so, you know, the Legislative Information Offices, we're headquartered here in Juno, but we have 22 other offices across the state that act as extensions of the committee rooms. So people are able to have a direct line into the committee process and can listen to the proceedings. They can participate by giving testimony when bills are open for public testimony and kind of get up-to-the-minute information about what's happening here in Juno. So we'll talk a little bit about those other offices tomorrow so you can kind of get a sense of what the network across the state is like. But in Juno, you have the unique opportunity to be able to go into the committee rooms and testify, put yourself on the record, and make your voice known, as well as having access to all of the legislators in the Capitol building. But for those of you who are unable to come down in person every time there's something you want to testify on, there's certainly other ways to participate, and we'll be going over that at the open house tomorrow. We also have a wide array of publications that we can distribute to you. We have photo sheets of all of the legislators' faces so you can recognize them when you see them around town. And we also have, a who's who handbook, so you can keep that in your pocket and learn a little bit more about the legislature, and we'll be able to provide those resources tomorrow.
Sure. How do you sort of advise people when they come to you and say, I'd really like to talk to my legislator? Do you, you know, what's a regular amount of visits one, you know, could expect, or how do you advise people on that?
Well, What I usually say is it's helpful if people want to speak to their legislators and influence the process, if they can start to kind of think about the issues on hand that may be affecting them that or that they care deeply about. And so if they can direct their comments about a specific topic or a bill, and we can help people kind of try to figure out which topics are up for discussion that they're interested in by helping people walk through the bill action status and inquiry system. It's called BASIS for those of you in the know, but it's an online resource where you can look at every piece of legislation and see what is being considered, and kind of we can help break down maybe the tricky process of figuring out what these bills mean and what they do. So usually we'll try to help people figure out what it is they want to talk about and then direct them to the right people within the legislature that they should be speaking to.
And I bet those are the kind of things you'll be talking about tomorrow night.
We certainly are.
All right, 6 p.m. at the Terry Miller Building, the old Capitol School behind the Capitol. And 6 p.m. to 7:30, if somebody wants more information, Betsy, where should they go?
They should visit our website, which is www.akleg.gov. They can also feel free to give our office a phone call at any point in time, and that's 465-4648. They can reach us by email at juno.lio@akleg.gov. But more than anything, we'd really love it if folks would stop by. We will be providing some snacks so you won't go home hungry and you'll walk away filled of information.
I think it's probably sort of obvious, but who would benefit from attending tomorrow night, would you say?
Just about anybody. Anybody who would like to know, who feels like they would like to be able to influence the political process a little bit more but aren't quite sure where to start or how to go about it or what they could even accomplish. We're here to answer any questions and to help people connect with the legislature and the legislative process in any way possible.
Okay. 6 p.m. Wednesday night, tomorrow at the Terry Miller Building. Thanks again for your time, Betsy.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Mm-hmm.
Capital City skyline photo. Skyscrapers shine the sun so low in the sky. Secretaries at the high top vendors, cabs honk at the bicycle messengers, rolling by.
What is civility? Does it matter? Are Alaskans more civil? The University of Alaska Southeast MPA program hosts a discussion of civility in the last frontier with Alaskan leaders Mayor Mike Navarre, journalist Dermot Cole, and Senators Anna McKinnon and Berta Gardner. Join the discussion in person at 360 on February 23rd at 5:30 p.m. or join the discussion online at 360north.org.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon on Tuesday, February 14th, 2017. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 15 minutes until the top of the hour. I have a crew here from Juno Douglas High School, including Alyssa Koyuk. Did I say your name right, Alyssa?
Yes.
Welcome to the show, Alyssa. Jennifer Nags, she's a counselor. Welcome.
Hi, Scott.
Nice to have you, Jennifer. And Hillary Young, program coordinator of the Suicide Prevention Coalition, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And you're also associated to JDHS. How?
I oversee Source of Strength, which is one of the student leadership programs in all the high schools, but it's at Source of Strength.
Okay.
So, or at JDHS as well.
Welcome to the show, Hillary. Let's get to Sources of Strength in a minute. Want to learn more about that. Jennifer, you want to start us out and tell us about sort of the Year of Kindness and the Week of Kindness and how JDHS is participating with that?
Yes, it was actually was wonderful to hear that the police department was putting kindness at a forefront this year. Last year, during the Random Acts of Kindness Week, the counselors, myself and the other counselor, put together a kindness week. It was very little, low-key. We had a little table to recognize caught-in-the-act moments. And our NHS students and Sources of Strength students and Interact students helped us with the table. They decided to take that on this year on their own. And so it was great. A committee of students got together from the three organizations and planned their kindness week for this week, contacted JPD to kind of partner up. And it's been great. We've seen a lot of, I think all our students do a lot of kind things every day. And they don't realize they can recognize it. And it's a good thing to recognize kindness.
All right. Alyssa, you are a senior at JDHS. Tell us about your role in all of this.
Yeah, I'm a senior at JDHS, and I'm in Sources of Strength as well as National Honor Society and Interact. And I've been just trying to get involved and get the word out there to my peers about what this Kindness Week is and what it means, and trying to get some involvement, which has been, I think it's been really great. There's been a lot of people coming to the table at lunch and talking about what it means and why we're doing this. And
okay, tell us a little bit about Sources of Strength. What's that mean? NHS is National Honor Society. I think people are probably familiar with that. Interact is the Rotary program. But what is Sources of Strength?
Sources of Strength is a peer-based leadership program. There's a very diverse group of students who join at the beginning of the year who are nominated, and there's adult advisors who kind of facilitate the learning. But the idea is to recognize sources in your life that are beneficial and that are of strength so that you can both yourself be happier and improve the climate around you. So the eight sources are family support, positive friends, mentors, healthy activities, generosity, spirituality, medical access, and mental health. And the more of these sources that you can recognize and increase and build upon in your life, the more resilient you'll be.
Okay. And Hillary, you're the advisor for Sources of Strength. Is that right?
Yes, I am.
How did you become involved?
So I'm a member of the Suicide Prevention Coalition, and 3-4 years ago, we were kind of looking at our programming and what we were doing, and we were realizing we had a lot of education from adults to students, but we didn't have any kind of student-to-student education that would really help change the climate in the school. And we thought, well, if we really are trying to help and make an impact, we need to get involved with the people that can make the most impact. And so we researched some programs, and Sources of Strength was one of the programs that is on the national, the best practice list of programs. So it's an evidence-based program for suicide prevention. And we also found that it's a great program because everyone can benefit from these different strengths in their lives, but it also allows us to work across different, with different programs and with different organizations. So since the beginning, we've partnered with the Violence Prevention Coalition, you know, kind of helping to address school climate, whether that's about suicide or violence prevention or bullying or substance abuse or whatever it is, it's broad enough to be able to work to prevent all of those different areas.
Okay. Alyssa, since so have you already had the Week of Kindness officially? Is that right? Have you?
It has just started this week, so Monday, and it'll continue until Friday.
Okay. But you've also sort of had this Year of Kindness going on. Have you seen changes in your school, or can you give us an example of maybe something that someone's done?
I can't think of any specific examples off of the top of my head, but in general, the school has been very accepting this year and very open to a lot of people, and it seems like even in light of all of the political shifts, people have been willing to talk about things and willing to be open.
Okay. How about you, Jennifer, from a counselor's point of view?
From the counselor point of view, because I see a little bit differently than the kids do, we have one young man who every day holds the door open for everyone for first period. And he doesn't do it for recognition. He does it because he does it. And it is fabulous, and we love to see that. I also have students today, as an example, is Reuben Willis from State Farm donated carnations to the high schools. And we saw a group of young men, basketball players, hand them out vigorously throughout the school. And one of the young men, you know, didn't focus on just his peers. He went to the female staff members and made sure they all had their Valentine's Day carnation too. So little things about saying thank you, trying to be respectful. It's been great overall. And I think the kids are or the students are very appreciative of kindness. It's just learning how to recognize it, and that's part of the learning.
Sure. One of the things I like about, you know, Lieutenant Sell has been on the show many times to talk about the Year of Kindness, and one of the things she likes to emphasize is reaching outside of one's peer group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right, because it's pretty easy to be nice. Well, not always, but can be easy to be nice to people you know, but to actually reach out beyond your peer group. Alyssa, do you have any advice or suggestions on how we can be kind to people outside of our peer groups?
I would just say to be aware. See if somebody, you know, if they have too many bags or if they have, you know, if they're needing something and they look like they could use some help, just offer the help. And if they say no, that's the worst that can happen. And being aware of the people around you, not just focusing on your friends, even though, you know, you want to focus on your friends, just being willing to look at other people and see how their day is going and give them compliments. And
all right. Hillary, any additions to that?
Yeah, I think what Alyssa said is great. And I would just say, you know, looking at a person as a person, period, and stepping out of your comfort zone. I think a lot of times we just get comfortable with our peer group and we don't interact with different groups, different ages, different anything, you know. And so just making a concerted effort to see who else is out in the world and what everyone else has to offer and what you have to offer them too.
Okay. What are you looking forward to this week? This sort of goes out to any of you.
I'm really looking forward to see what compliments people are giving each other. We have these little cards at the table that students can fill out and address, and they're all going to be delivered on Friday. And I think that's going to be really great because you're not really expecting them to come, but I feel like a lot of students are going to get recognition for something that they've done that's appreciated. And then also the kindness tree. We have a tree that students can fill out with a kind compliment or an act of kindness they've witnessed or any of those sorts of things. And it's been growing. Even in just these past 2 days, there have been compliments that have been added.
Okay. Well, it sounds like a great program, and it sounds like you're all working very hard to make it happen. Is there anything the community can do to help support you from the outside?
I would say not for Kindness Week, but overall, if you check in with your schools and see what can be is needed. I know with National Honor Society, they run a school pantry for students in need, and like we just put in our newsletter that we needed some, you know, small little grab-and-go items, and we've already had a response, and some parents have already turn stuff in. So there's some great opportunities out there. Just kind of search them out.
Okay. Hillary Young, Alyssa Koyuk, and Jennifer Nags, thank you all for coming on the show. Is there anything we're missing that you'd like to add?
I think we covered it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. Mating for life may be the human ideal, but most bird species in North America mate for a single breeding season. Some may team up with the same mate the following year, just because both stay in, or return to, the same territory, but such togetherness is relatively rare. Because most birds of the North Temperate Zone migrate, remaining in touch with a mate throughout the autumn and winter is difficult. For instance, fewer than one-fifth of song sparrow pairs are reunited. For long-term fidelity, look among the larger birds. Large resident birds such as hawks, eagles, and ravens have wide territories, meaning few contacts with the opposite sex. Maintaining a relationship through the winter may assure breeding in the next season. You'll often see such birds in pairs throughout the year. Most seabirds meet and breed in colonies, but marbled murrelets, little relatives of puffins, breed inland in old-growth forests. They have no chance to meet each other in a colony, so when a male and a female get together, they stay together. In the animal realm, birds still provide the best examples of seasonal mate fidelity. Most birds form devoted pairs for at least each breeding season, not something that can be said for most mammals. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Thank you for tuning into a Juno Afternoon today. Tomorrow on the show, William Todd Hunt will be here to tell us about Orpheus, the Orpheus Project's production of West Side Story. Robert Fagan and poets involved with the Convergence book will be here. We'll get an update on Red Cross activities with guest Lori Wilson, and we'll get the details on the upcoming Downtown Restaurant Week and an update from Eagle Crest tomorrow on a Juno afternoon. Currently 43 degrees at the Juno Airport, and the forecast for tomorrow, Wednesday, calls for rain with highs around 43, southeast wind 10 to 15 miles per hour. Chance of precip 100%.